Welcome, listeners, to the Grand Bouffe, the Big Feast, with myself, Cole Smithy, and this week's host, Mr. Bill Scurry. As always, we are here to copiously consume international politics and culture through the prism of a single film and a different craft beer. Welcome, Bill.
It's a pleasure to be here, Cole. Thank you for inviting me, sir.
It's such a pleasure to have Mr. Bill Scurry, filmmaker and podcast bon vivant.
That's a good way to put it. Boulevardier, arthritic whiskey drinker. There's a number of things, topics and badges I wear very proudly, yes.
That's good. I can see them. He's wearing them all on his shirt. There's lots of them.
It is. It's a paisley print shirt. Yes. If you're going out and no one is looking at your shirt, to me, I sort of feel like you've maybe made a mistake with your personal expression that morning. The dressing oneself, especially as a man in this city, and I hate to come off as this kind of snobby dick, but I'm going to start. I feel like it's self-expression. It's a little bit of an art form to dress yourself. You can be. It certainly can be.
Absolutely.
And I feel like I lost a lot of weight back in 2003, had the ability to buy new clothes and different clothes, mm-hmm. and developed an aesthetic.
Nice.
So at that point, I thought, this is another avenue of self-expression. I don't paint.
Right.
I don't draw.
Right.
I don't make music, but I can knot a tie pretty well.
That's excellent.
I can match my belt to my shoes, things like that. Very simple 101 type things. And that's where I put my energy in the morning for 7 minutes. I get it right.
7 minutes well spent.
You give us 7 minutes, we'll give you the word.
So we agreed on Ken Russell's Whore.
Yes.
Which I'm really excited about for a number of reasons. I saw this movie when it came out in 91, and it was everything I could do to keep myself in the chair during the first 10 minutes. I just wanted to walk out. I was so disgusted, and I think we're going to have a fun time talking about how culture has changed since 91. I recently watched Eyes Wide Shut, and I had a similar feeling about Eyes Wide Shut, where it's so provincial, and I feel like this movie comes across. It was very shocking in 91, and it's a sexploitation movie, I would say. It's based on a play. It mm-hmm. comes across as being very theatrical. And of course, it's Teresa Russell, who I don't think is related to Ken Russell.
No,
although
it's a coincidence.
Okay, just total coincidence. So open up our can of worms for us over the. Oh, I should bring up the beer over this beautiful beer that we're drinking. I thought that Stone's Arrogant Bastard might be an appropriate expression of craft beer for this movie because
that's nice.
There are a lot of arrogant bastards in this movie. Yeah, it's a delicious. This is one of my favorite ones. Cabin Fever. Mm-hmm. Eli Roth's, I think it was his first horror movie.
One of his first, yeah. Maybe it was an actual first.
Prominently featured arrogant bastard mm-hmm. in that movie. So it's got, of course, the arrogant bastard demon on it. And it says, "You're not worthy." And I think it's probably around an 8% ABV. It's a strong one.
It sits on the tongue. It has a very nice flavor to it.
7.2. Oh, it's
almost
delicious.
Almost like a cup of coffee, that same kind of heavy feeling. Yeah.
Yeah, it's got a little bitterness to it.
I like the bitterness to it. Some people don't know how to handle it, but mm-hmm. with a whiskey, not so much. With a beer, it's perfect. That's exactly the kind of Susan of bitterness you definitely want to that.
And they've opened a brewery in Richmond, Virginia, my hometown.
Your hometown.
Which has made quite a splash, and so Richmond has turned into this craft beer destination now.
Every time I drove, because I lived in Carolina for a couple of years at the late 90s, I was in Durham. And so I did that commute back and forth from Suffolk County here on Long Island down to Richmond. And I remember, I guess at 95, past, right past 95, you take that, I think it's 78, where it starts to peel through when you get over the Carolina border. You're going through Richmond. I think it was the R.J. Reynolds Company had the box of cigarettes. Am I mistaken? It's almost like a cascading four smokes. And I remember that was. I knew where I was if I saw that building appear on the side of the highway.
There
time.
You go.
That was my register of Richmond, Virginia.
There you go. Yeah, Reynolds Metals is a big company. I think still going strong out of Richmond. Mm-hmm. All right, so Whore. It's controversial already.
Mm-hmm.
Your movie's called Whore.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if we're going to go back and...
It's a derogatory term.
It is a derogatory term. Or I guess some people own it. I don't know. Maybe it's a derogatory... Yeah, I'm sure it's a derogatory
I think now term. Everyone's a sex worker.
Yeah. Okay, yes. I will go with you on that one. That's absolutely true. Don't you have to engage, I feel like, in a little bit of deflation, the way, for instance, you would say, how much was $10 worth in 1938? Or, you know, you could buy Jack's and a pack of gum for a nickel back in, you know, back in 41. And there's always something with the culture when even, you know, again, this is in 91, I was 16. So, you know, this is something I remember well. I was an avid moviegoer. And trying to remember, well, what was the cultural Weltanschauung of 1991?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? The
Weltanschauung, the idea that people were, what was the worldview in movies? What was, again, outside the pale was inside the
pale. Is that German?
It's German, yes.
That's great. I've never heard that.
Oh, really?
That's terrific.
It's a word most people just read in a book, but they never hear anybody say it.
It's not Zeitgeist, but it's similar to Zeitgeist.
Yeah, it's a worldview. Zeitgeist, I think, is the spirit of the time. Zeitgeist is like the flavor in the air. I think a Weltanschauung is sort of the approach people take when making things. It's sort of a worldview.
Gotcha.
That's what I'm thinking. Is like Ken Russell.
Yeah.
There's no mistaking Ken Russell's approach and worldview from the course of his career. You know, and you take Ken Russell, you add 1991 to it. You know, you add women in love to it. You add the devils to it. You add the boyfriend to it. You just try to get a gauge on what's going on. And then, you know, you have this movie, Whore, comes out in 91. What does it mean today? The Lair of the White Worm. That was the other choice.
That was the other choice, yeah.
Yeah, that was a good one, too. I had seen that, and I hadn't seen this, so I definitely wanted to talk about this.
Yeah. I did have a girlfriend walk out on Lair of the White Worm. When I was living in San Francisco, she made it through about the first 20 minutes.
That's a bad sign.
That relationship went no further.
Destined not to be.
Yeah.
So, you know, Russell making a movie in 91.
And Tommy. We didn't mention Tommy.
Tommy? Yeah, that was the first Ken Russell movie I saw.
Yeah.
I mean, it was around the time that the musical came out. The revival of the musical, I guess it was in 93 or 94. That was a big deal. My first girlfriend was big into that. We had heard Tommy ad infinitum because my parents played it, but I think when I was in college, people were just understanding there was this thing called music and a band called The Who and a man named Daltrey all for the first time, and that's fine. That's what you do when you go to college.
Mm-hmm.
But this movie was a response to Pretty Woman, as if it was a corrective to the saccharine thing of Gary Marshall.
Mm-hmm.
Just weird that, of all people, Ken Russell would assign himself the duty of correcting Gary Marshall's footprint in the culture.
Do you think that's what happened?
You know, my research just cursorily said that he had that in mind.
That's so interesting.
There was some idea. And in some of the interviews I saw with Teresa Russell, she said... And she was on Letterman talking about this. It's on YouTube. You can take a look at this. And there's
great.
Believe it or not, there's not a ton of back. I mean, this is just one of those great people that, you know, it's like, where the hell is she?
So she's and not to be confused with Kathleen Turner,
right?
Who I always, for some reason, I have this Teresa. I have this blind spot between Teresa Russell and Kathleen Turner, where I mesh them together. Serial mom.
Interesting. Kathleen Turner always reminded me of like a Jenna Rollins type. There's something breathy and deep voiced and husky.
Yeah.
If anything, Teresa Russell always just twisted herself around Deborah Kara Unger, if you know that. And it's like those two actors were like, and you could even think of a little bit of Kim Cattrall in there too.
Right.
It's like, that's like three actors, one spot. I mean, I'm not impugning any of them.
Kim Cattrall, Porky's.
Porky's, Split Second with Rutger Hauer. She was fucking incredible. Big Trouble, Little China. Porky's was great.
Yeah.
Ken Russell was making a corrective.
Mad genius. Ken Russell, we just got to put it out there, this mad British genius.
Yeah.
Altered States, which I recently watched again, mm-hmm. and I saw it when I was working in San Diego.
Never seen it.
Yeah. Working at a campus drive-in, the campus drive-in, a block from my apartment, and saw... Altered States many times, but this movie it has this layer of artificialness that acts as this buffer. A lot of it, most of the movie really, is Teresa Russell just monologuing.
Mm-hmm.
The movie's almost one long monologue.
Right. And correct me if I'm wrong, but that is not a Russell hallmark. That is something that is that's a staple to this movie, but it doesn't really exist in the rest of his oeuvre.
Correct.
Yeah. unusual. You know what it reminded me of? Did you watch those Billy Friedkin, Tracy Letts adaptations?
Bug. I really liked Bug.
And Killer Joe.
And Killer Joe. I really liked that one too.
I hated Killer Joe.
Excellent.
I thought it was, there was something about it where I couldn't slip into the thing. I couldn't relax and let it wash up. Bug was a little bit more successful because I'm a big fan of Michael Shannon. I think Killer Joe seemed like you were watching a bunch of actors doing a play. Like, it was almost like Glengarry Glen Ross with actors who weren't fit for it on Broadway, and here's a revival.
Nice.
And I didn't know if McConaughey and the rest of the people who were in Killer Joe didn't really serve the material. Also, it's very outre stuff. I'm not here to talk about Killer Joe, but right. The idea that there was this artificiality to it,
right,
where you're seeing something very stagey, and like you said, there's a barrier or a wall, a little bit of a hump to entry here. You have to get over that in order to sink into the rhythm of the movie.
Well, I think it's a way of approaching the transgressive material at hand. And this movie especially, I wondered what this film would have been if John Waters had directed it. Because I really felt like, you know, it just needs to get pushed. You know, it's there, but it just, I think John Waters could have done, he could still do it. You know, I think mm-hmm. it'd be great if John Waters did a modern update on whore, and mm-hmm. he would call it sex worker.
Yes. Or he might still call it whore.
He could still call it whore. So I really like I'm a big fan of transgressive cinema mm-hmm. and things that cross all sorts of taboos. And this movie, for a movie that ostensibly is about sex, there's very little sex.
Thank you for bringing that up.
In the movie.
We should lead with that because that is the nut graph. Make sure people know that this movie has a dirty mouth, and it is very explicative of the topic. But I mean, the imagery is kind of chaste.
Very,
it's very chaste. Even for $91, it was like, where did that come from?
Yeah.
Was there some Catholic League thing? Like, who got up on their shit about this that they decided to make a big deal out of it and make it seem like Ken Russell's, you know, setting a blowtorch to taboo? Because I feel like there's...
Was it NC-17?
Yeah.
Wow.
Based on what, Cole? I will ask you. What happened? Because is it the topicality?
Well, here's what it is that the ratings board were just having a field day back then.
Yeah.
You know, you're still coming off of the Tipper Gore...
Yeah, record labeling.
All that stuff. And so it was...
Oh, Two Live Crew.
All of that stuff. Yeah. It was really just a hot time where, you know, somebody just saying something, you know, talking dirty was enough for people to lose their shit.
Some kind of Bob Dole morality going on or some middle American thing. The last holdover of Reagan-era values was before Bill Clinton gets in and we sort of begin to... Not that everything turned around, but... There was definitely a loosening of the sphincter after that, for sure. And this movie may have been that Bush, Poppy Bush era thing, like a zeitgeist, if you will, of thinking we're easily scandalized.
Mm-hmm.
And you had people who were pushing against the boundaries and people who were trying to push back. And I guess the MPAA made this one of their things to dig in their heels on, which seems ridiculous now.
Yeah, but it's interesting that it's Ken Russell, this British filmmaker who... has made his career on just doing outrageous versions of all sorts of classic. He did classical stories, and this one, I'm glad that you pointed out that he did it as a response to Pretty Woman, because at least then you see what he's working against.
Right.
And I think when you understand that about this movie, it's more approachable. But I have to say that I think Teresa Russell is awful. There's moments in this movie where I just think she's terrible. I just think her acting is so just not good. No bueno. Like, we got to get a retake. Come on.
I started off, the very first scene is her pedaling her ass. I guess it's in that tunnel just north of the city, somewhere in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And she meets Antonio Fargas. And she has this completely hyperbolic conversation with a guy who says he wants to have anal sex with her. And she pushes back at him. And It's putting its checklist out really early in the movie to let you know what kind of product you're getting.
Yes.
And I did have the same feeling that you did. It's like, God damn, who's like, can we get a retake? But then something funny happened. I feel like I got swept into it, and I began to see maybe what Teresa Russell and Ken Russell were going for. And, I mean, I'll tell
you. I agree.
Look, I'm a heterosexual man, and she is beautiful. She is pulchritudinous in a way that they used to make actors, where she is not willowy. She has some, you know, I saw she's blonde, and she has these sort of almond eyes, and her pupils are gorgeous, and she's curvy as hell, and, you know, and she's got these long legs that go on. To have her as the person telling the story, I mean, first of all, she doesn't look like a prostitute.
No.
Or a sex worker.
No.
It's preposterous. Any more than Julia Roberts did, or Laura San Giacomo back in Pretty Woman, whatever the state of the art for a sex worker was, she's pretty much what the filmed version of a sex worker was.
Right.
Having a really pretty person tell you these things and essentially whisper dirty things into your ear for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
I'm not made of steel. You can punch through to my heart pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And I think I got lulled into what they were trying to do, the artificiality of it, and I would say the falseness of her performance, the things that seem less than genuine. I don't know if you noticed this, but I took a note here. She has this thing, this very actorly take she does. It's a little bit of a huff. It's a cross between a teenager's exasperation and a little bit of that, an adult person's over it feeling, where she would, and it appears, I could have made a supercut of about 85 times when it appeared.
Yeah.
And it winds up, any other director or a script continuity specialist would have come in there and said, it's like, well, what we need to do is wash that out of you a little bit. That's a crutch that you're using as a performer, but it doesn't ring as real. Yeah. It's the kind of thing that an acting coach would say, what we're going to do is internalize that. We're not going to indicate it. We're going to internalize
it. Right, and she does it too when she speaks in her fake male voice.
Yes.
Which he's pretending like she's a guy, and she has this fake male voice that she always goes to. Yeah. And that, too, is very repetitive. And what I find appropriate to the character, though, is that it assigns her intellectual arrested development. It assigns her that place in her youth where she stopped growing intellectually. Mm-hmm. That's what I get.
The character.
From the character, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. Excuse me. Yes, I would agree with that. You're sitting there watching her recount this hideous roundelay of what happened to her to get to the current place that she's in now. So you do have these two layers of narrative where she's running from her pimp, who's, you know, essentially trying to kill her. He's a very antagonistic guy. And then you see all the standard stops along the way, the trolley stops of alcoholic husband, repossessed child, every ruined thing along the way. And those things are very tropey and very stocky. But if you read what the origin was, this was based on, well, I mean, unless the guy was bullshitting us, this was based on the the stories of a bunch of sex workers in England in the 80s. So it's supposed to have some element of reality to it.
David Hines is the playwright.
Yes, David Hines is the playwright. He was a taxi driver, and he would do the HBO thing, I think, of collect stories while he was out hacking at night.
And Benjamin Mouton is Blake, her white pimp.
Yeah, I didn't really recognize him. I thought this thing had this weird little... I mean, did you notice it had an Actor's Delight of cameos?
Yeah.
Strangely enough, Jack Nance shows up, of all people.
Yeah, Jack Nance of Eraserhead fame. And, of course, the maestro himself is the waiter. Ken Russell comes in and does just the most hilarious, campy waiter that you've ever seen. I want to go to that restaurant. I want Ken Russell to come take my order.
By the way, that restaurant, man, it was so...
Oh, it's so terrible. So what I would talk about... A really ugly set. Theater production off Broadway that would accept that.
Yeah. It was so anodyne.
Lame.
There was not a single bit of even the sound bed of hearing like there's some kind of violin music in the background, or the clinking of tables being bussed and food being served, and the hum of conversation. You quite literally only heard their conversation. There was no other diegetic sound coming out of the room.
Yep.
We could chalk this up to Ken Russell. This budget was famously minuscule.
It must have been.
He had nothing to work with. In fact, Ken Russell ran the camera on this movie. He's credited under the name Alf Russell.
Oh wow!
So he had to run. He wasn't the shooter. I mean, he wasn't the DP, but he ran his own camera, I think, to save money.
Elizabeth Moorhead, by the way, of Bewitched fame, one of the cameos.
Yeah. No, that wasn't. No, it's I think her daughter or It's now you're thinking of Agnes Moorehead was in Bewitched, right?
Oh, okay. I'm confused. Okay.
No, this was Elizabeth Moorehead of Seinfeld fame.
Oh, right.
She was
right,
in the
right.
Pez Dispenser episode, apparently.
Gotcha. And Ginger Lynn, who really was a porn star.
I mean, and not only Ginger Lynn was busy back then. Ginger Lynn was making all sorts of weird exploitation movies, too.
Behind the Green Door 4.
Yeah. But, I mean, she showed up in a lot of, I want to say, slasher movies. She had that moment where she was doing, I want to say, not Trauma, but maybe New World or Full Moon Studios kind of movie. She was doing some stuff like that. She wasn't, she was lapsing in and out of porn for sure.
Yeah.
But I remember seeing her a lot on USA Up All Night, the cut down versions of her movies. She wasn't an angel, but there were movies like that where they were really exploitative movies. I mean, it was perfect. She knew exactly what she was doing, and she was the person you get for that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of cameo, the one that really got me is the first John she gets in the car with. It's like there's almost this big hearse, this big black Cadillac with full tint.
Oh, yeah.
And there are these two guys in there, this bug-eyed driver and this old creepy perv in the back seat.
Yeah.
And he starts forcing her to give oral sex. The guy who was driving was one of these actors. He was a TV guy in Los Angeles around this time, a guy named Robert O'Reilly. And I knew him instantly because he was a Klingon on Next Generation.
Whoa.
And he was like Worf's, I don't know if you watched Next Generation. He was Worf's like sort of frenemy rival amongst the Klingons. And they all considered Worf to be a sellout because he was with the rest of the white people on the Enterprise. And his Klingon, Gowron, was this like true believer Klingon. And the thing is, this guy had, some people have the face to run makeup, right? Like, you know, Ron Perlman can run latex, no problem.
The guy
that Del Toro uses, Doug Jones,
yes.
Born for makeup.
Oh boy, amazing.
Right?
Amazing.
This guy too,
yeah.
He understood, they slapped the latex on him and he wasn't buried inside of it. And his eyes, and he would wear that ridged forehead.
Wow.
And he was such an indelible part of why Next Gen was so great. And it's like, this is around the time of Next Gen, but it's a much different role, and thinking, oh man, he's sitting there calling her a bitch and saying, suck my dick, bitch.
Right.
And I'm like, what a weird time this was to be an actor.
Wow.
I know. It's like you can't imagine a greater variance of two roles, one or the other.
Wow. I love it. I love that kind of insidery knowledge stuff.
Well, Antonio Fargas was here too.
Starsky and Hutch. There wasn't a single episode of Starsky and Hutch that Antonio Fargas was not on.
Yes. And not much else beyond that.
And I did like how they played with the cliche of, you know, he's her savior, instead of her having the black pimp part that he by any reasonable Hollywood tropey stereotype would have in that role. Mm-hmm. He's the savior.
Yeah.
And he's just this.
He's still a magical black man, though.
He is a magical black man.
He runs around with like a bag on his shoulder, a magic stick, barefoot, speaking in a strange sing-songy artificial patois.
Well, you hit the nail on the head there, didn't you?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if Ken Russell had a lot of African-American or African-English cast members in his movies. I think they tend to be strictly Caucasoidal affairs from what I've seen in my life.
Yeah. Caucasoidal.
Oh, man.
Gonna look that one up. All right, kids. I hope you have your dictionaries out. You're gonna need them for this podcast. So I'm just looking at Russell's itinerary here, and you know he had done The Music Lovers. It was his first movie, and then The Devils was his second movie.
That's insane, man.
Which is so crazy. Have you seen the uncut?
I did.
I bought a version that was supposedly the uncut, and it wasn't.
You could do a little hack job yourself because the footage is on YouTube. It does exist out there. Oh, and I found a fan cobbled together version on the torrents on the sort of you know the way people get things these days. I mean, you give me a version to pay for, I will. And I mean, you know, so they have the money. His estate should have the money.
Yeah.
But I did. I've seen a completely put together version of it. And,
okay.
You know the. You're talking about a VHS transcoded version of like quite literally, I think it's a minute 30 that they pulled out of it. It's a very close version. The version you have on Blu-ray is almost as close as you're going to get.
Yeah.
It doesn't lose anything.
Yeah.
For taking it out, and nor does it add much from putting it in.
You
get the impression of the movie. It doesn't stop how brilliant that fucking movie is.
Oh,
it doesn't stop how incredible Derek Jarman's sets are and everyone.
Oh, those sets are just. They're so bold. They're so outrageous.
Yes.
I mean, this is somebody who has a vision, and they're going for it.
It what's the razor thin line between it works and it doesn't work? I think that there's no way. I can't imagine that movie on any way, shape, or form not working. I mean, you just have so much juice involved in the creativity of it. So, I bet Derek Jarman could make something that was bullshit. Or there could have been a version of that movie with those sets that still had, it still had Oliver Reed and still had these actors, and it didn't work. But, I mean, it's magic. I mean, it is this propulsive version of magic that you wonder, how did human hands do this? Or what moment was this in history creatively that we had the ability to make a movie like The Devils?
1971, which what's the story on it? Why is it not being properly released in its entirety?
Well, it's
it was banned. I know the Catholic Church came out against it, and a bunch of people
fucking Catholics,
put up a fight.
There was a documentary, I think a mini documentary came out a couple of years ago from that guy. You know Mark Kermode, the English BBC film reviewer? He's kind of an internet rock star. Does a lot of movie reviews. Well, he, I think, rode herd on this documentary. The rationale I've heard from people who know what they're talking about is that there's still this inhibition for putting in the last few minutes or the last chain of seconds because of the transgression of women masturbating on top of the icon, you know, the cross.
Right.
And I feel like you're watching the most cut to, you know, most uncut version you can find, I believe still intimates all that anyway. You get the orgiastic physical libidinal carnal lust on top of Jesus or near Jesus.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
like that's transgressive enough. And it's like for some reason that last little bit of women grinding on the cross, the actual Jesus on the cross is the last bit that they're hesitant to put in for some bullshit reason. Who knows what the power is that this thing still has? What in the world of 2018, where nothing makes sense and nothing matters, why is this still something we can't have?
Well, see, this is the problem is that when you take something like that out, you fire people's imaginations so much more. You fetishize the thing so much more by what you take away, and that's there's a lot of that going on in society right now that we're in, which is shocking considering that, 1971 when he made The Devils, that was the height of the free love and the hippie movement. It was before Watergate. Granted, it was after 69, so everybody knew that, the party was over. But still, people were living out their artistic ideas. When did John Waters come along? He was busy in 71.
Yeah. Oh, he started. I mean, Flamingos was 74, I think.
Okay.
I think Girl Trouble was 73 or 72.
Okay.
He was doing his thing. He wasn't trying to piss off the Catholic Church that much. He was just happy getting the goat of pearl-toting wasps in Maryland. That was good enough. That was good enough for him.
Yeah, it's a good starting point.
It's an easy target to hit. Well, when did Pasolini make Salo? What year was that? Was that 70?
I think that was 74. I could be wrong. It was his last movie.
Yeah, I mean, but talk about people like shooting for white whales. By 74, you still have people out there with harpoons in their hand trying to take down big topics.
Yeah, which you don't. I don't think you really have that so much anymore. I don't see us going in that direction either. I don't know if you know about the Brie Larson thing.
Yeah.
But she really made no bones about the fact that she's just shilling for positive film reviews from minorities who she thinks don't know any better, who don't have a critical, don't have a critical mind. Because what does it take to be a film critic? Well, hopefully you are somebody who thinks critically, because that's the job. Mm-hmm. It's not called film praise. It's called film criticism.
Well, there's plenty of film praise available. Film criticism is a different apparatus altogether.
But I think they're trying to wipe out film criticism. I think that the plan is, they did like the USC Annenberg Institute, who came up with this study. They're financed by Google and Disney and Epix and all, Sony. And I think that what they're really trying to do is I think they're trying to get rid of criticism.
A critical apparatus?
Yeah.
We talk about this a lot on my podcast. I don't get it, And you mentioned it before we started.
77 for Tosalo, by the way.
77?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's even closer,
Mm-hmm.
It's practically the same year Close Encounters comes out,
Yeah.
We talk about the death of the critical apparatus a lot on our podcast. So it's interesting you brought this up. I mean, and we are merely playing whack-a-mole with small bore topics like Lana Del Rey and you know, video games and Bruno Mars and things that honestly have no effect on the larger culture. They're merely commercial ventures.
Yeah.
And yet there's still the idea that it's not even the, like, Disney, Fox, Comcast, whatever the company's called this week, whenever they sell the fucking thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even like they... Bob Iger doesn't give a fuck who's reviewing his movies. I mean, he couldn't possibly care because Black Panther got all of our cash. That's fine.
Yeah.
I almost feel like it is this fan-based thing. You're talking about people behind the... people who are out there on YouTube, people who are out there on Twitter or Reddit, even worse... who are actively savaging a critical apparatus. You know, and I mean, I take that personally because what it does, my friend Noah has, my podcast partner Noah has...
Yeah, give a little pitch for your podcast while we're here at this moment.
It is a trivial offering we put out once a week called I Don't Get It. Two middle-aged men discuss a topic that is something that is beloved by younger people. When that could be as early as 10 years old, frequently it's someone who's probably 20 to 30. It is hopping a generation and seeing what exactly is this inscrutable blob of pop culture producing. What is cup stacking? What is Bruno? I mean, Bruno Mars is an easy one, but it's like this week we did, what is the flossing dance that the Backpack Kid did in the Katy Perry video? We get obscure. And I feel like, you know, our contemporaries always say, like, well, I had no idea this was happening. I had no fucking idea this was happening until we tell them. And it's like, well, great, now you have an opinion. But but my co-host Noah has a phrase called the death of expertise. Uh-huh. And he's a guy who has put a lot of, he was a stand-up comedian. He was a copy editor. He worked in publishing for most of his adult life. And he runs trivia shows. He's a quiz master, for sure, almost by trade, sort of an impresario. And for him, the idea of getting something correct or having a style to it, or, you know, like a Funk and Wagnall style, like a Chicago manual style, those things are very important to him. And when you begin to issue incorrect, afactual things, or there's no idea that you can't say this doesn't adhere to rules, or there's no study of what came before this or what spat it out. Everything is new all over again, and it's as if there's no institutional legacy. And for him, he takes the death of expertise very hard, because it means the person who puts all those years of expertise is going to get themselves cut in line by someone who has no expertise. And how we got to this topic is very weird. I'm trying to backtrack how this goes back to whore.
Well, you know, we're talking about how Ken Russell, how his lineage of films came about, and the movies that he made. And he was making these formally based movies. He did this Mahler film. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
So he did a movie about Mahler, and then he really took the reins in his teeth and made Tommy.
Yeah.
Which was, of course, the first rock opera by The Who, and Anne Margaret, who...
Tina Turner, Oliver Reed.
There you go.
The whole deal, the whole schmear.
And it you know, and people would talk about the beans coming out of the television set onto Anne Margaret. And you really don't need to take any drugs when you see this movie. And if you do, that was how it was intended as well.
Having listened to Tommy has some spasms of you know, phantasmagoria to it, for sure.
Yeah.
It's a groundbreaking piece of music for the day and age it was, and it had these big, big things in mind. I mean, and I'm a fan of prolix, pompous music coming out of England. My favorite band of all time is Emerson, Lake & Palmer.
Hilarious.
I mean, you know, all I need is a Moog organ.
That's your favorite band of all time. That is.
I saw Carl Palmer two nights ago. He was playing in around Times Square.
Because
Emerson and Lake are dead.
Right.
Carl Palmer's the only one still alive. Carl Palmer is a machine. He's 68 years old. He can still hit those drums with this amazing alacrity. It's insane.
Oh, yeah.
It's
wild. Oh, yeah. Wow. Great. Okay.
And
cool.
So for you know, the Who making this thing, it's already wild enough, but the Ken Russell movie is a complete development bolted on top of it. It is a separate entity.
Oh, yeah.
That's what's amazing about it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
What he added to the visual styling of it, how he made this thing that is distinctly Ken Russellian.
I don't know. There you go.
Yeah, there's something really weird to it. And that was my, I think that was my introduction to Russell, was The Who.
See, and what I think is interesting about this movie is that this is a stripped, is what Psycho was for Hitchcock. This movie is for Russell. It's a stripped down.
Yeah.
We're not, this movie's going to cost us 20 bucks and a couple of promises to make, and we're just going to get her done. And that's what he did.
Yeah.
And he knew, all props to Teresa Russell, even though I think her acting is not what it was in Bad Timing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know Bad Timing?
I know of it. I've seen bits and pieces of it. I haven't watched the whole thing.
Oh, my goodness. We did it on the podcast. You've got to see Bad Timing. Our Garfunkel is amazing. Yeah. He's so good. I really think in Carnal Knowledge that he's better.
He's great in Carnal Knowledge.
Than Nicholson.
Yeah, I could see that. I could see that.
But he got Teresa Russell knowing damn well she was going to show up knowing her lines, which is no small feat in this movie, because most of it really is a monologue.
Heavy book, yeah.
And she's nailing it. She is.
And it's you're asking a lot of an actor to look into this screen and offer a monologue. I mean, just what I know of actors, you need to be speaking to somebody and that you know exactly the conversation you're having with them. And it just seems like an easy thing to say to do, but it's another thing to do correctly. And whether or not she nails it entirely, I believe that she gives, by her own standards, a pretty airtight performance. And mm-hmm. that she holds the attention and she's got charisma mm-hmm. and she's one of those people that has the it thing.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a world full of it havers.
Mm-hmm.
But to be honest, to be a blonde it haver who's, gorgeous beyond belief is not nearly enough. Not in a mm-hmm. world where Julia Roberts, is the standard. If she's the coin of the realm at the time, then Teresa Russell is going to be worth bronze.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. I think she does the job you're asking her to do. And it is... She's not Glenda Jackson.
Yeah.
She's not Vanessa Redgrave. Vanessa Redgrave.
Who I saw on Broadway. Three Tall Women.
Was amazing. She great?
Yeah.
I mean, she's doing King Lear, next year.
Yeah.
Glenda Jackson.
Glenda Jackson. Yeah. Glenda Jackson. Yeah. Yeah. Glenda Jackson. Amazing.
But, he had the run of actresses out of the UK. And in fact, he was instrumental, I'm sure, to helping make their reputations at the beginning.
Yeah.
You're talking about a hungry guy, probably in his early 30s, coming out of whatever, I don't know where the hell Kent, his origin was, where he hopped over into movies and decided with this head of steam, I'm going to make these films.
And you have to talk about Ken Russell in the context of Stanley Kubrick, because even though Kubrick was an American making films in England, yeah. He was, the fact that he made A Clockwork Orange. A Clockwork, I would say, The Devils is about the closest that you can get to that level of bizarre, sociological, stylized cinema.
Mm-hmm. I weigh The Devils heavier than Clockwork. I love Clockwork.
Yeah.
I mean, the first of all, I think that there's something.
I agree with you.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm not.
No, I agree with you. I'm not pushing that ball.
Yeah. First of all, no one's seen The Devils. So, other than people like you and me, you're far more likely to hit someone who's seen Clockwork.
Yeah.
I mean, The Devils, when I was watching it, I got angry. I got horrified. I felt like this is exactly speaking to the current thing that we're in right now. There's so much of it. Again, as a person who was born into the Catholic Church and is an atheist and all that, I just feel like there's so much of this. there's so much of what it's saying that is timeless, and maybe the message went underground and it means something anew now. To watch The Devils after 40 years or so, 45 years, maybe longer than that. I like what it had on its mind textually, in addition to how beautiful it is and how incredible and how brawny all the performances are. Ken Russell as a young man doing, I guess you had to be a young man. But then where the hell does the inspiration for that come from? If you're coming out of the 60s, no one's done something like that before. Maybe you're influenced by musicals. Maybe you're influenced by Powell and Pressburger. Maybe you're influenced by David Lean. I don't know where the hell it comes from. But maybe it's all those things or maybe it's none of those things. It's just it's a beautiful movie to come out with.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think it's perfect that you pointed out how this is like the unplugged acoustic set
mm-hmm.
to some degree, and that it is so spare.
Mm-hmm.
It lacks just about any filmmaking chicanery. There is a very straightforward linear narrative. The photographer was this guy named Amir Makri, who, believe it or not, the guy who shot this movie for him is the guy who shoots the movies for Zack Snyder and Michael Bay now. This guy did Man of Steel, and he did Transformers like Age of Extinction.
Wow.
Can you believe that?
No, I cannot.
I mean, I think this is his first gig.
Yeah.
I mean, you start somewhere.
You got to start somewhere.
You start focus pulling somewhere. I mean, this guy came out of TV, but it's like, okay, you begin here, and all of a sudden you're running Optimus Prime somewhere else decades later down the line for all the money in China. So, I mean, you don't see any of that. This doesn't have wonderful, lush photography.
Uh-huh.
It has the sort of perverts sense, that particular Ken Russell thing, you know, that perverts ideal. I mean, to go back to the very beginning of what you're saying, there, you know, I start watching the movie, I'm like, all right, I know there's something lurid. There's something exploitative about this. There's something that's, you know, you want to hear a woman talk about anal sex. You want to hear a woman talk about blood. I mean, if you're Ken Russell, that's how you're breaking down the barriers. That's how you're throwing the stuff out there and saying, I'm trying really hard to be outre. There's still some taboos in the culture. And let's have a woman talk frankly about all these perverse sex acts that are, you know, you discard, or you know, in the day and age, they're perverse sex acts that are bordering on pornographic. You don't ever show them. And you don't even show nudity for the most part. Like, her body remains covered. She's wearing revealing clothing, but it's like you saw like one nipple of hers. That's about it.
Yeah.
For a very small period of time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, Russell is trying to titillate the audience at the same time as he's trying to scandalize them a little bit, as well as give some kind of humanity or dignity to sex workers. I really do feel like there is a humanizing component to it, which is what he was asking Teresa Russell to do.
So I'm, you know, looking at his movies, and I would put this movie in a similar category with Crimes of Passion,
which I've never seen. I have to admit ignorance.
So Crimes of Passion, that's Kathleen Turner. Maybe that's where I got the Kathleen Turner. Oh, see, now I understand.
Makes perfect sense.
Now I understand my own logic. It's funny how you can not understand your own logic. And that has so Kathleen Turner is the sex worker, and Anthony Perkins is the perverted priest or minister who comes to her. And
it sounds like you're describing a Ken Russell movie.
Yeah, I know it does. and it's filled with all of that Paul Schrader hardcore imagery. By the way, have you seen First Reform?
I have.
What did you think of First Reform? I know we're completely off subject.
No, it's fine. I mean, it's on people's minds right now. I wasn't impressed by it. I run hot or cold on Schrader, but I run cold on Ethan Hawke. I don't buy it.
Oh, really?
I really am one of those guys.
Okay, interesting. Because I thought this is the best thing Ethan Hawke's ever done.
I would totally believe that. And the thing is, I did not enjoy Ethan Hawke's performance. I just have such a low estimation of him that it's like, you need to go up to get to like -2.
Sheesh.
I know. I'm a bastard when it comes to this guy.
No, we all have our strong opinions.
And for some reason.
You got to have them.
I just picked a strong opinion.
I respect that. I like when people have strong opinions. I have them too. I don't care if they're opposed to mine. That's not the issue.
I made him a bad guy on a Wednesday for some reason. It just stuck that way. But I mean, the movie itself, I thought.
Don't get me started on Whoopi Goldberg if you want to talk about. Stinks up every movie she ever set foot in.
Even Theodore Rex. I guess you're right.
Well, there you go.
I thought that the whole thing about him adhering to his Ozu Bresson thing was so self-conscious and so precious, as if it's like, all right, old man, I get it. You know, you used to hit this fucking thing hard. And I had just Metrograph down and, you know, down in Chinatown was showing a bunch of movies of his, and he came out to them.
He was introing a bunch of them.
I watched a shitload of them. Yeah, I went down there.
Did you see him intro one?
Yeah, sure. I watched Taxi Driver for the 100th time.
Yeah.
I saw Light Sleeper with Willem Dafoe.
Yeah, well, how did that hold up? Not so good.
No, actually, that one I enjoyed a lot.
Oh, okay.
That one almost had that same feeling. I remember a couple of years back, I went to go see What's the Evil Ferraro movie with Walken, King of New York.
It's
almost that feeling of like, oh, that's a New York. It's almost in that same time period.
Yeah.
And I really like King of New York, by the way.
Me too.
It's great.
Oh, yeah. One of my faves.
Fishburne, man. awesome in that movie.
Oh,
it's really good.
Oh yeah, that was like his first thing.
It's kind of right out there. Well, I mean, his first thing was like Apocalypse Now, but yeah.
When he was really
leading man role.
Leading man role.
Cowboy Curtis.
Yeah, he's chewing up the scenery in that thing.
But Willem Dafoe was actually really good. I mean, he is really good. And
yeah.
Had a early supporting turn from was it Sam Rockwell? Might have been one of his first few movies. Light Sleeper was good. Light Sleeper had this prickly, crystallized, cold, chilly New York energy of a pre-gentrification New York right before the last few minutes of Dinkins. You feel like this is what you're looking at.
Yeah,
that one I liked a lot. And I saw American Gigolo, which I'd never seen before.
Oh.
American Gigolo, man, is all like, talk about
so
a
stylized,
a big timpani drum announcing itself between the Armani clothing and the Blondie Giorgio Moroder soundtrack.
Oh yeah,
it's there are some things about it that are incredibly beautiful. It is melodrama. I mean, par excellence.
Yep, total Yeah, the story itself is so melodrama.
But it's the same story as Light Sleeper. It's the same story as First Reform. Those movies are all the same. He's been repeating himself. This is the Schrader thing.
Well, that's what Hitchcock did.
Yeah, I know, but I feel like
that's what I'm coming back to about Russell. Because I wanted to just see from a female perspective, you know, how this movie fits in with something like Salome's Last Dance. Have you seen that one?
No. I'm really light on Russell. I haven't seen nearly enough.
And so, of course, we all know about the story of Salome, and that's just it's great. It's such a party, that movie. Mm-hmm. It really feels like, you know, this is a party and you're invited. You know.
That's Russell. If Russell's working one way,
that's true.
Russell is. I mean, one of my notes here is that, you know, Russell loves nude bodies.
Yes.
I mean, for both reasons, Russell loves the idea of like Botticellian nude bodies, Raphaelite figures.
Yes.
There's some. It's like going back and reading like Francois Rabelais or Jean-Jacques Rousseau, where he wants to revel in the human body. He loves sex. The scene in Women in Love. You know, there's actually watching that for the first time and seeing.
Yeah.
Oh, I see what he's doing here.
Yeah.
This was Scandal back in, I guess it was 70, I think, it was Women in Love, or 71. I forget when that came out.
Let's see.
Maybe 69. I'm all hitting all over the place here.
Oh, sorry, that is 69. Yeah.
69. Okay. And yet, there's something so. You know, it's a completely non-sexual scene to me. I get everyone could talk about how homoerotic it is, and I have a tin ear for that kind of thing.
Right.
But I could just look at two people wrestling nude and somehow walk away and feel like I don't feel any sexuality to it. But somehow it just winds up being a human scene. Very enjoyable scene that just has wonderful value.
Yeah, well, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think that he has this I think he's a student of art. I think that he is a lover of art, and it comes through in his compositions. And the beauty of human bodies interacting, that thing is something that he loves. And I hadn't gone far enough. I'm looking at IMDb, and I'm realizing that Ken Russell started his career in 56,
mm-hmm.
and he had done all of these television short documentaries for years, and then his first film was The Billion Dollar Brain. He did The Billion Dollar Brain.
I wish you guys could see Cole's face. It's beautiful.
In 67, and then Women followed that up with Women in Love.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, you're talking about a workaday filmmaker here.
Oh, yeah.
You're talking about somebody who knows how to come on the set, hit it under budget, and get out. And
it was a job.
Live to do it another
Whether day. Whether he was in Pinewood or Leavesden or wherever they shot these things, maybe somewhere in Metro London. Yeah, I mean, it was a job. I mean, people, the Brits did not think of this. Some of them had high ideas as an art form, but a lot of them didn't. A lot of them thought of it. You know, they were just tradesmen in that early Hollywood sense where people didn't think of filmmakers as artists for a long while. Even in the days of John Ford, even in the days of Howard Hawks, they were people who were very good at their job, but did people think of it as art? No. You would need until later on when the new wave came around, then, you know, the Cahiers du Cinéma crowd would start thinking of these people as geniuses. That comes a long time. You need to stew in that world for a long time. But Ken Russell, you know, he obviously came up in one orthodoxy of doing this as a gig, and then applying all this critical. I brought up prog rock not for no reason before, in terms of, like, you know, loving the music. the prog rock guys were these kids who sat home and they had their knuckles wrapped. If Steve Howe from Yes didn't have proper positioning of his fretting on the guitar as he's doing Roundabout, right? You know, you can tell as a kid he learned proper form, and they were drilling out Eric Satie and Camille Saint-Saëns and all those. And it's like, and what do they do with that? They make these fucking balls out songs like Tarkus, and Yes makes Close to the Edge. They take the classical and they make it into rock and roll. Ken Russell was as prog rock as anybody there ever could have been, for sure.
There you go. Wow. I don't know if we can even say anything more. You just, like, blowed out the whole, what was your German term?
Weltanschauung.
However you say that. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Bill Scurry.
Thank you.
I think we're going to have you back on the program at some point. Billion Dollar Brain, by the way, Michael Caine, 1967 Ooh. Film. A former British spy stumbles into a plot to overthrow communism with the help of a supercomputer. But who is working for whom? All right. The last thing I want to say about horror is just that I think that Ken Russell is a lover of humanity, and I think that what he's doing with this movie, his transgressive pushing forward of the social ball down the field of humanity and time, is that he was giving voice to this very neglected part of humanity,
mm-hmm.
and trying to give this woman a voice. Granted, it's, you know, it's through a playwright, but I think that that was what he's doing here, and I think you do get that. For as artificial as her performance, Teresa Russell's performance is, you get the humanity of her character. She's somebody who had her child taken away from her. Her pimp takes 100% of her profit. So she's somebody who's living by her wits.
Her body is a sale.
And her body, literally, yeah. For no reason at all, yeah. Other than the confused state that society has put her in.
That's a great way to put it, man. Yeah.
And it's painful as fuck. And the shit that she has to endure and go through, or the brutality and the dangers that she has to endure, are real. And it's the kind of shit that people don't want to look at, they don't want to know about, they don't want to face. And yet, for anybody, it's closer than you know, or than you believe, or than you think, to your own existence.
I like that. Yeah. Yeah, one of my notes was exactly about, you know, Ken Russell the humanist, Ken Russell the dignifier, Ken Russell the man who is giving this sense of humanity to somebody. I mean, and it is a dispossessed, the word whore, whether it's used ironically here or if it's used as like a reclamation, there is that sense of, this is a person who knows the rules of the game in and out. You're going to hear every single bit of it, and it's going to make you as uncomfortable to hear as it is for her to live through every invasion, every perpetration of invasion into her flesh, that sort of thing. Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. I mean, and you know, maybe what the movie has an old man doing it with a low budget, and maybe he was a little addled. And maybe he's not shooting in England, maybe he's shooting in Los Angeles, which everything changes the, you know, you wind up having a gel lens put on top of the camera every time that makes it a little more fuzzier of an image. That maybe is what you could chalk it up. Maybe if he does this movie 15 years earlier, maybe he does it in 1982, it winds up being a different movie. Maybe then again, if you did that, maybe it winds up ratcheting up the prurience. Maybe it winds up being more lurid and lascivious and less, you know, trying to make you feel bad for having an erection, something like that. I mean,
well, here's what I want to know. Where's the next Ken Russell? Because
I
don't
question.
Need to hear about Nolan again. You know, I mean, when that guy learns how to fucking make a movie, let me know. But in the meantime, I want to hear from people that really do know how to make movies,
you know,
and really how to take chances and really push boundaries and really say something. And I don't care if it's not perfect. You know, this movie is probably a B-. If I was going to, you know, write a review of this movie and give it a grade, I might give it the same grade that I initially gave Lady Bird, which should have been a D-. But that doesn't mean that it's not a really valuable movie, because I'd like to point out that the distance between B- and A+ is the same as it is between B- and D.
That's true. Yeah, I like thinking about that. Now, that's a great topic. I think I wanted to ask you who they were. Who were the guys, or I say guys, I mean, who are the people who are getting closer to that same level of filmmaking? And I realize that I don't think anybody's going to hit that kind of classical bent where they're going to use Mahler to score their movies, or they're going to be inspired by Benjamin Britten the way Ken Russell would have. But in terms of people who are either taking formal license to do such things, or they're really interested in the lives of humans in various versions of extremists, you know, I was thinking on the way over here about that guy, Jeremy Saulnier, who made Murder Party, Green Room, and Blue Ruin. He makes these incredibly, they're gothic southern noirs. They're a little different, and yet I kind of feel like...
Well, what about the guy who did, Black Snake Moan?
Craig
Brewer.
Craig Brewer.
That guy's got it in him.
Yeah. Yeah, there's something. There's a formalism that is, I think, similar. I mean, he made
Black Hustle Pink, and Flow.
Hustle and Flow. That's what I was going to say. I think he got co-opted into TV after that.
I think that's what happened. Yeah, he got co-opted. But he's got that in him.
He does, but you would need to get him back on a track to a guy like that, why would you say it's like, hey, if Stars is going to give you 12 hours...
Well, he's got to pull a John Sayles. He's got to make his money and then write his own scripts on his own time and go make his movies.
John Sayles, by the way, great example. John Sayles does a lot of that. You know, he will portray the mortifying of the flesh. And no characters ever, to me, feel... In the last year, I've kind of become something of a micro sales expert just because I did a big episode of our mutual friend James Hancock's podcast.
The Wrong Real Podcast.
The Wrong Real Podcast.
We all love it.
I feel like Sayles is a guy who, I mean, has been invested in this since he came out with Secaucus 7, you know, back in 79.
Oh, yeah.
And he's a man who has never lost track of what those people are like. He's not having people eat their own feces, like in Sallow, for instance. He's not getting that quite far with it. But there's a lot of discomfort, but it's discomfort that is close to home. John Sayles is kind of living a Bruce Springsteen text of a video from like the Born in the USA album.
Yeah.
And
Lone Star is one of my favorite movies.
Lone Star is incredible. Lone Star is a masterpiece.
It is.
I mean, I think Matewan is great as well. There's
Matewan's an absolute masterpiece, no question.
Something about between, you know, you split the difference between Brother from Another Planet, Matewan, Lone Star. I mean, even, you know, Sayles hit a movie out of the park just a few years ago called Amigo, which he filmed in the Philippines. And it's like, it's about the Philippine-American War. I was like, nuts. I can't believe this guy still has a fastball at the age he's at. He, too, given the money, he would be able to make some magic. But much like Ken Russell, he rolled his snake eyes. And it's like, just people weren't willing to, you know, give him the kind of cash he needed because he wasn't reliable enough, I guess, to return the investment. Not reliable as a filmmaker, but he wasn't going to produce Transformers Dark of the Moon like his photographer did on this movie.
Well, I hope that we've piqued our listeners' interest to watch Horror. Sadly, it's not streaming anywhere right now, so you really have to just go and
steal it like I did.
Well, there you go.
Sorry.
Yeah, and you know, or buy a DVD from however you do that. But I want to thank you all very much for listening. Please do Le Grand Bouffe, The Big Feast, a favor and just Google Cole Smithy Patreon and give us 5, 10, 20 bucks, whatever your account will manage per month, so that we can continue to make these delightful podcast episodes for you and have a different guest on every week. But of course, we will have returning guests, as I suspect Bill might be returning in the not too distant future.
It's just 4 train stops away from me. I'm okay.
I like it. It's a Manhattan thing. don't get me started on the Alamo Draft House in Brooklyn. Do not get me started. Just don't go there. That's all I can tell you. Thank you all so much for listening. Please remember to turn your cell phones off when you're walking, driving, riding a bicycle, or watching a movie. Le Grand Bouffe, The Big Feast is a production of Smart New Media.